Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we find out about a man who records sound for a living and his One Square Inch of Silence project. We talk to a professional mermaid, and we remember local musician Jay Bennett, who played with the band Wilco. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Gordon Hempton is an acoustic ecologist. For three decades, he traveled the world recording nature sounds for the likes of National Geographic, Discovery, Microsoft, and NPR. But about a decade ago, he began to notice it was getting harder to record natural silence without the intrusion of jets, highways, power lines, and other modern sounds. In 2001, he designed a place in Olympic National Park, One Square Inch of Silence. And his goal is to protect that one spot from noise intrusions. Independent producer Andy McDaniel has more.
It's a damp, sunny morning in the Olympic Peninsula, and I'm about to embark on a 3-hour journey with the sound tracker. He's taking me to a place where he says I'll experience pure natural sound. He calls this place One Square Inch of Silence.
I'm Gordon Hempton, the sound tracker. And basically, I'm an acoustic ecologist, which means I'm a listener. I listen to places.
Hempton is about 5'6", and has the permanent tan of someone who's spent his life outdoors. He's ruggedly handsome and wears just a hint of a gray beard. He's founder, president, and spokesperson for One Square Inch, which is a place in Washington state that he's trying to protect from man-made sound. When I first read about the place, I thought about all the modern noise I've learned to live with. Cell phones, sirens, traffic. Even in my quiet apartment, there's the hum of my refrigerator and my computer telling me I have a new email. I wondered what it would be like to experience real silence. So I called Gordon Hempton, and we arranged this hike. We meet at the Ho Rainforest Trailhead, where the hike to One Square Inch begins. It's chilly and overcast, and Hempton's wearing a down vest with jeans tucked into rubber boots. He's carrying a black device the size of a thermometer, a decibel meter, which he uses to measure everything he hears. A couple birds, a babbling brook, my rain pants, and so we're off. Minutes into our hike, Hempton pauses and motions for me to be quiet. The air is cool and wet, and huge mossy spruce trees tower over us.
So this is where the noise meter turns into a quiet meter. Let's just see how low it goes.
He points the decibel meter into the air and waits.
So with the wind, it's 33 dBA. And now it's getting even quieter. Let's take another reading.
It was the first of many times he would stop to test the silence. The idea for One Square Inch actually came to Hempton many years ago. See, for most of his life, Hempton has been a full-time explorer, traveling the globe to record nature sounds for companies like National Geographic and Discovery. Sounds like
the surging wind, particularly through tall grasses, a variety of brooks, for example, that give a nice babbling sensation.
He even won an Emmy when he recorded the sounds of dawn on six continents. And in 1989, he got a grant to record the sounds of Washington State for its 100th anniversary.
And so what I used as sort of my musical score were the handwritten journals of our early pioneers. And I wanted to recreate that wilderness soundscape. Well, this was very difficult. Even though I was able to visit a few quiet places, I did notice how even a single passing jet would destroy many square miles below it.
He found out that historical soundscape didn't really exist anymore. He says you might even call it extinct.
Chainsaws, jets, vibrating power lines. Noise is almost everywhere. There is not a single place left on planet Earth that's undisturbed by noise. I realized if I could preserve even one square inch of silence, defend that one square inch, the quiet could impact noise just as much as noise impacts quiet.
And so one square inch was born, but not really. Hempton wasn't ready to put his idea into practice. He came up with the idea for a natural silence preserve back in 1989.
And I really thought that while it was a very effective point management strategy to preserve natural quiet, it was somebody else's job. Basically, I was busy enough. I was an acoustic ecologist traveling the world, listening to the land, and really living the dream. Well, that dream ended in the fall of 2003 when I lost my hearing. And this gave me time to think. I was out of work. I couldn't imagine myself being anybody but the sound tracker.
The sound tracker, the man who spends his life chasing sounds, could no longer hear. And what was worse, he kept hearing sounds in his head, man-made sounds.
I woke up one night and there was this thumping sound off to a distance. And so I figured it must have been a new class of super tanker. And so I listened to what I imagined to be pistons turning around, churning, thumping. I listened to it, almost thinking that my hearing, by gosh, is getting really, really good. But I was soon to discover that actually it was the beginning of my hearing loss, and that sound was coming from my head and would get much, much worse.
Hempton went to his doctor, who said it was a middle ear problem. But there was no cure, and surgery might just do more damage.
After more than a year went by of losing my hearing, I just basically said, I want my old life back, all of it, everything.
So Hempton began to think about what had been going on in his life when his hearing vanished. A few months earlier, he'd turned 50 and gone on a bit of a self-improvement kick.
So I started taking the supplements, I started adding a few of my own, and because I noticed that I was thinning in the back of my head, I started splashing on some Rogaine. And this sort of dripped around my ears, and it kind of felt good. Felt like kind of hair lotion. Well, fast forward, it was only a couple months through this therapy that I did lose my hearing. And even though all the doctors and everybody that I talked to said, no, that has nothing to do with anything.
So Hempton discontinued everything, the supplements, the Rogaine. And 2 months later, his hearing started to come back, first for an hour, and then for several days at a time. And with his returned hearing came a new sense of purpose.
And when I knew I was going to get my hearing back entirely, I said, preserving silence is not someone else's job. I can do this. This can be a one-man job. And so Earth Day 2005, I established One Square Inch. The beauty of One Square Inch is that it speaks clearly to the issue. Defend one square inch of silence in the center of Olympic National Park, and the 1,000 square miles around it can be managed.
You might be wondering just how someone goes about defending silence. It's not easy. Hempton visits the spot periodically and monitors for what he calls noise intrusions.
I measure the noise level, and then I identify the noise intruder and write them a letter.
And these letters, do they ever get read?
I've gotten 3 responses, favorable. Alaska Airlines said that they would not fly unscheduled flights over Olympic Park. I'll take that. American Airlines said that they would not fly over Olympic Park. And Hawaiian Airlines, that I caught one day flying a maintenance flight over Olympic Park, said they normally don't do that. They'll never do it again.
Hempton's obsession with silence is not just about being a purist. The spread of man-made sounds is affecting the behavior of wildlife, especially birds and other animals that rely on sound to figure out where their territory ends and the next guy's begins. It's also affecting us humans.
Even though you have habituated to sound, your body does not. The body still listens. The body still produces the stress chemicals. Hearing, in evolutionary terms, is more important than sight. While we did evolve eyelids, we can afford to shut down our vision and go to sleep. No creature ever evolved earlids.
Maybe the most important thing about preserving silence, though, is just maintaining some place, even if it's a tiny place, where we can go to experience silence, to remember what it's like to be able to hear an entire valley, which is what I'm about to do. We've come to a spot beside the trail where an enormous tree stands like an archway, its middle rotted away. We're almost to 1 square inch.
So we've arrived at the turnoff. This is what we've been looking for. And behind me is the stilted spruce. We'll go in about 100 yards to where the stone marks 1 square inch. And below that is the jar of quiet thoughts. The jar of quiet thoughts is basically where people can read the thoughts of others that have preceded them and deposit their own if they want.
The Jar of Quiet Thoughts is an actual 1-quart mason jar with slips of paper inside. There's only one rule about the Jar of Quiet Thoughts.
You cannot repeat it or quote it. The thoughts must remain quiet. There's no talking at 1 square inch. Try to keep your noise to a minimum and just sort of absorb the space. I'll have the sound level meter in my hand, and I'll record the decibels of the quiet. And also, if there is a jet intrusion during that, I'll record that as well, and then write a letter to the intruder.
I walk in a single-file line behind Hempton, through the stilted spruce. After about 50 yards, I spot an ordinary-looking log with a small red stone on top to mark the designated square inch. We've arrived. All that's left to do is listen. First, I open the jar of quiet thoughts and read a few of the entries. I can't disclose their contents. Then I settle into a comfortable spot and try to absorb the absence of noise. Ten minutes pass. I hear birds, wind. To be honest, 1 square inch sounds a lot like all of the other inches of forest we passed through today. After 5 more minutes of soaking up the quiet, Hempton gives the signal, and we make our way back through the stilted spruce. On the other side, he's ready with a debriefing.
So during our listening session right then, it was short, and the bass ambience was 32 dBA, which is fairly quiet. Now, there was a jet intrusion during that time, but it was immeasurable. But also, it's not an intrusion that I will write a letter for, because that's kind of an argument that I'm not willing to wage at this point.
It's hard not to be amused by the idea of protecting a tiny little piece of quiet, the size of a potato chip or a slice of pepperoni, smaller even than the human ear. But make no mistake, Gordon Hempton knows that that little red stone is just a catchy placeholder for a much bigger idea.
Probably the biggest value of 1 square inch is it starts us thinking about silence and how sound behaves and how far sound can even travel. I get some responses like, well, 1 square inch of silence, why don't you just put a jar on top of the stone? And so I think to myself, huh. This is a real statement made from the modern world.
If Hempton is right, if natural silence really is going extinct, then hiking here today has been a rare experience, like spotting an endangered bird. Except that silence is more subtle. By definition, it's anticlimactic.
Here at Olympic Park, the budget for natural quiet management is zero. In fact, there's no person that's actually working to preserve the oral solitude here. It all comes down to a stone and a jar.
That feature from independent producer Andy McDaniel. This is Sidetrack. For those of you who thought mermaids were strictly the realm of fantasy and Disney movies, some good news for you. They're alive and well and swimming in Florida. Well, kind of. I want to introduce you to Marina Anderson, otherwise known as Marina the Fire-Eating Mermaid. She's a dancer, fire eater, and most importantly, a mermaid. Yes, for work she puts on a shell bra, squeezes into a fishtail, and swims. She recently did her final swim at the Wreck Bar in Fort Lauderdale, a classic tourist bar where patrons could view her and other mermaids through portholes along the walls. The bar is closing down for renovations, and its future is uncertain, another part of American kitsch culture that could be lost forever. Anderson is hoping that isn't the case. I recently talked to Anderson about how she became a professional mermaid.
That is a very good question. I ask myself how I wound up doing it, too. I've been a free diver all my life. My dad taught me to free dive back in the West Indies. I'm kind of Caribbean raised. And at age 3, I already had a mask and snorkel, and I was already diving. And so breath holds and free diving, it's pretty much part of our lifestyle over there.
Well, what is free diving right away?
Well, it is diving without scuba equipment. It's mostly diving to depths and doing it all on breath holds. And there are different ways that people do it. Sometimes people will do it in a manner that's very athletic. They'll go for depth and time. And in my case, I kind of would do it more self-indulgently. I do it so that I can look at fish a little bit longer, or I do it to do certain movements and such. So I kind of worked it that way. And it wasn't until I was maybe in my... like I would say maybe 8 or 9 years old when I got to go to Florida for the first time. And this was a big thrilling experience because in living in the Caribbean, I'm used to beaches, you know, these beautiful places and such. But Florida became this totally different place to me because it was all about kitsch and tourist traps. And I was completely enamored by that. So, of course, a trip to Wiki-Wachi became quite an event. And to see that not only were these women doing what I do all the time, but doing it as a career just totally changed my concept of what I was doing.
And then you were hooked, so to speak.
I was pretty much, yeah. And it wound up, I already had so much, you know, experience doing underwater swimming. I watched Esther Williams movies like crazy. My mother was very into old Hollywood, and she made sure that I got my fill of watching her films, and it certainly made a difference. I was influenced by Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid, not Splash so much initially. So to watch these scenes that actually wound up being filmed in Wiki-Wachi Springs was kind of this great little connection that wound up manifesting itself to what, you know, you see today. I'm less Daryl Hannah. I'm definitely more Anne Blythe.
And Wiki-Wachi was a... explain that real quick for people who don't know.
In its heyday, Wiki-Wachi was amazing. They had this huge group of women that were trained. They were actually housed in the area nearby. You know, pretty much a fascinating lifestyle that these women had. And they had to learn, you know, they were going through their, they had to learn aqua ballet. They had to learn a whole barrage of training so that they could do these shows. And the mermaids themselves didn't pop up until after Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid was created, and that synthetic tail was, they allowed them to use the synthetic tail for promotional reasons, and then they wound up bringing the mermaids into the show. But at first it was all aqua ballet, and it's remarkable that to this day that theater is still there. And we're an endangered species. There are not too many of us around really performing mermaids, and especially what I do is a little different. I perform at a bar, It's an underwater bar. And this was something that was really common in the golden age of tourism. But now I believe only two places remain of this style. Of course, the Rec Bar, which is right now going to experience a renovation, which is kind of, we don't know really what the outcome of the renovation is going to be. And a place called the Sip and Dip in Montana.
So let me ask you about the tail, about the whole costume.
Sure.
Describe the tail. Describe getting into it and swimming with it. I mean, it's not something that you see at all anymore.
No, it is a monofin, which is something that actually is a more contemporary style fin. It has 2-foot inserts, but it's one large fin that it's connected to. And it is used not only by free divers, but it's also used by swimmers that are training. They'll do it to practice their butterfly strokes and such. It's definitely a good training tool for swimmers as well. And they make them in different grades and hardnesses and such, sizes and such. I found a really nice one that moves very flexibly, and I thought that would really suit the fishtails because my aim was to try to look as comfortable and natural underwater with all these things that really are counterproductive to proper hydrodynamic movement. So here I am with all this hair and seashells and accoutrement, and I'm pretty much not built for swimming quickly at this point. But the whole idea is visual. So when we stop by the portholes and we pause, the hair flows in a certain way. Everything moves in a way that it looks enchanting to the viewer. They're staring at it going, holy cats. And that's what I personally was trying to go for, more of a visual art. And with the fishtails, they're all made of swimsuit fabric. They're very tight to the body, and that kind of to help with the streamlining. And I spray paint them as well to kind of give it a little extra dimension and such. But I make all the tails myself.
Now, you're out by a pool right now.
Yes, I am. I'm always by a pool. I'm always at a pool. Right now, I'm doing some choreography for the upcoming Hukilau event next month, and I'm really looking forward to that. So it's going to be at the Bahia Cabana pool, which is a little different. It's a smaller pool, and so this stuff is going to be a little bit more aqua ballet Esther style rather than the underwater stuff that you see through the portholes at the Rec. And I always like a challenge like that, so it'll be a lot of fun to see what we can come up with in that area.
Now, what sort of mental preparation do you go through before a swim? How do you get into character?
Usually when you have everything on, that pretty much does it. I'm always training. If I run between 5 and 13 miles a day, you know, the 13 milers I only do once a week. But for the most part, I'm constantly training weights, everything, to become as efficient as possible as far as cardiovascularly and everything. You really need to. So when you have everything on and you first put your head underneath, it's a completely different environment that you're in. So it's actually quite easy to get in character. Or in my case, I've always been a performer, so it really isn't that difficult. Once I have everything on and it's time, you can go through that personal transformation where you're like, I'm on, it's time to go, and you do it. And I train girls, the other members of my pod, I train them in that style, which is tricky because a lot of them are, you know, aren't too experienced in acting. And to act in an environment such as this, where not only are they underwater, but they're holding their breath, and to make it seem like they're not is the goal. So a lot of them, with a lot of them, it comes naturally, and then eventually, you know, just kind of step by step, they start becoming more and more fluid and more natural. And within a year or so, they do really well. In my own practice, I'm always looking at videos. I'm always breaking myself apart, trying to think what could we do to make this better physically, movement-wise, you know, with the limited resources that we have at the Rec Bar.
Well, here's a question. Why do you think people are fascinated by mermaids? And I'm thinking both in sort of the classic folklore sense and also maybe in the more modern, kitschy sense. Why do you think that fascination is still there?
I think, well, they're definitely, and I use this word carefully, they're sensual creatures. They definitely are. You can look at the Disneyfied version. You can look at all these different ones, and there's something very very sleek and streamlined about them. Everything about their build, their personality, their demeanor, it's never hyper or nutty. It's almost like everything is tactical, and I personally like that aspect, or I try to lean toward that. If I were to see a mermaid for the first time, I wouldn't expect her to be all, hey, how's it going? I really would like to see her just look at you going, you're in my turf now, you know, that kind of a feeling. And that's what I try to do with the wreck, because here we are, you know, being seen through portholes in a much more intimate environment than, say, Wikiwachi, where they have to be at a far distance and be seen from quite a ways away because it's in a spring. And here I'm maybe about, you know, 10 feet away, 8 to 10 feet away from them. They're looking at me right there directly or closer, and I have to make eye contact and make it to see me thorough. And I think people are very intrigued by that, because I've done performances where I'll perform in a pool where they'll see me from the surface, and I usually don't speak when I do that because I'm too focused at that point. I really don't need to talk to people first before I go down. It makes it very awkward. So I'm thinking, you know what, I'm going to just focus and stay on my... And when people watch me perform, they start to think that I'm something else other than a human wearing a tail in a lot of instances, and they'll talk to me slightly differently, like I'm a pet or a dolphin or something. They're kind of looking at me going, oh, you know, would you like something? But they say it almost in a very, kind of the way a person would speak to a kid or a dog, you know, trying to speak to a puppy or something. I find it's really hard to describe, but I find it rather fascinating that they're taken in by that illusion enough, even though they know, technically, I've got a fishtail, I drive home, but at that moment, they're involved in it, and the mythology behind it, the films, everything that kind of, you know, all the pop culture references to it have always rather gone in that direction. The men look at it from a completely different standpoint than the women. The women look at it as things that they've always wanted to do, perhaps, or something that they've been intrigued with. Children look at it from a fantasy section of their lives, a fantasy aspect. Everybody has their own reasons behind it, and, you know, and then there are the scientists who go, manatee. So I guess there are many different angles to be that a mermaid can be perceived from.
Well, if anyone wants to know more about you as a mermaid, where should they go?
Well, I have a website. It is called Medu Serena. That is like Medu, like Medusa, and that accommodates my fireside, all my stunt performances. That's the joke, is that I'm the Medusa. So Medu Serena. Serena, it means mermaid in Spanish. So MeduSerena.com, and you will find me. I have a MySpace page. If you look up Marina the Fire-Eating Mermaid, if you Google Marina the Fire-Eating Mermaid, better yet, I guarantee you'll find me, because there are not too many of us around.
That was Marina Anderson, a.k.a. Marina the Fire-Eating Mermaid. You can find her swimming and performing at various spots around South Florida. A link to her website can be found at our website, will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Still to come, we talk to a physicist about the antimatter bomb featured in the movie Angels and Demons, and we remember local musician Jay Bennett. Stay tuned. You're tuned to Sidetrack. In the new Hollywood blockbuster Angels and Demons, the Vatican is threatened by a bomb planted by the shadowy organization, the Illuminati. Its explosive charge is based on antimatter stolen from CERN, the Swiss particle physics laboratory that produced antimatter in the Large Hadron Collider. Physicists want to step in with some caveats. U of I professor Kevin Pitts says CERN, the collider, and antimatter are very real, but antimatter's potential is just starting to be realized. He talked about it with Tom Rogers.
the amount of antimatter that they have and they can actually take is immeasurable compared to the amounts that we can actually make in laboratories.
Is there a worry that there's that distinction between fiction and fact in this movie, that there's misinformation about what antimatter really is? Does this count as dramatic license, or is this something that ought to be either corrected or obviously explained?
We would like to take the opportunity to explain it, but we're certainly don't have a problem with the fictional account of the antimatter and the science behind that. For example, there's a lot of fiction in Star Trek that is that is not science fact, but it's still very fun to watch and enjoyable. And so it's not that we have a problem per se with the technical details, but we are taking this opportunity to clarify that some of the actual science fact is actually is just as exciting as the science fiction.
Is there a 30-second layman version of what antimatter is without going into, obviously, the very complex things behind it?
We're made of particles. You probably remember from your science class protons, neutrons, and electrons. And in fact, nature allows for particles like protons and neutrons to have what are known as antiparticles. These particles still have mass. They would have weight and take up space, but they would carry the opposite electrical charge of for example, a proton would have an antimatter counterpart, which is known as an antiproton. It's a real particle which we can produce. What's special about antimatter is when it comes into contact with matter, the mass of the weight of these particles can be converted into pure energy. So that's actually very interesting in the fact that you can have this very efficient transfer of mass into energy. That goes back to Einstein and E equals mc squared.
How much energy can that produce, though? I ran across one quote saying that if you put together all of the antimatter that CERN has produced so far, and we're talking about incredibly minute quantities, I guess, you'd be able to power a light bulb for a few moments.
That's right. Another way we like to say it is that if you take all the antimatter that's ever been produced, you could probably warm up about one cup of coffee. The transfer of mass into energy is incredibly efficient. The problem or the limitation is the minute quantities of antimatter that we can produce, and that's we were actually calculating I should also say that there's a laboratory here in Northern Illinois known as Fermilab,
right,
where, in fact, I do my research and a lot of us do research as well, which is very closely related to the laboratory in CERN in terms of our physics reach. And if we look at how quickly we can make antimatter today, and we say, how long would it take us to make the quantity that was used in the movie? That is about 100 million years for us to get to a quarter of a gram of antimatter, which is what was used to make the bomb in the movie.
But as we see with computers and memory, the old standby logic is that things multiply over time. So how much of a leap do we have to get between what we're producing now and something that could be useful, much less weapons grade?
Well, I think you're exactly right that there's always a possibility for major technological improvements. But one of the things that's important to note about antimatter and in fact that it's not really a viable energy source in the long term, because the amount of energy you needed to create the antimatter is actually much more than you would ever get out of it. And so even with technological advances that might make it much more efficient or easy for us to make antimatter, the amount of energy that would go into that is way, way larger than the energy you get out. In the case of a bomb, of course, it's spectacular to get all the energy out momentarily. But then, in fact, if you look back over how long it took you to put that energy in, you had harnessed more energy to make the antimatter than you would ever hope to get out of it.
U of I physics professor Kevin Pitts talking with Tom Rogers. Pitts adds that transporting any amount of antimatter is currently about as impractical as you can get. He says science isn't even close to the point where antimatter can move from place to place in a battery-operated case like that in the movie. You're listening to Sidetrack. Frank Paul grew up in a town outside Detroit, where most people work in a factory making cars or something having to do with them. But Paul defied his family's expectations of him. For the past 20 years, he has tinkered with toys and tools for the sheer enjoyment of the process, rather than a predetermined end result. And he's been able to etch out a living with his sound experiments. He's specifically interested in the sound of youth and childhood and has been collecting toy instruments for years and years. Independent producer Zach Rosen has more.
The first thing you see as you walk into Frank Paul's first floor workspace is a dismantled piano.
Oh, the tour.
See, it's if you're not careful, you'll walk right into it. It's so close to the door. On top of the piano are a bunch of odd-looking metal bells. Beyond that are a half dozen old euphoniums hanging on the wall. Then there's this thing sticking out from under a messy table.
This is called a gicella, and it's a guitar neck on a cello body.
The gicella is only the beginning.
This is called a little tyke. This is where I keep my zithers. These are chimes. My name is Frank Paul, and I live in Wyandotte and Ann Arbor. And I make a living writing music for theater, film, and dance. And playing with several bands. Currently it's with Scavenger Quartet and Little Bang Theory, which is a band that plays music on toys.
The Little Bang Theory whistles and strums and thumps its way through songs that lilt whimsically from one off-kilter melody to the next. And it all happens on kids' toys and instruments.
Anything that creates a sound is potentially musical, you know. And so the delineation between sound and noise becomes considerably less important.
But Paul says he's not really trying to make a point by only using instruments made for kids. He just really likes the sound of them.
It's nice to have a band that isn't interested in saying something. Just like it's nice to build machines that aren't really doing anything in particular.
And the machine he's talking about? Basically what Paul's done, and has been doing for years, is made these little musical towers that play themselves. Across from the wall of euphoniums and opposite a drum set are three columns of instruments. There are a few mini organs, some chimes, and one of those little tyke xylophones with the multicolored keys. Paul's taken a bunch of those wood hammers from an old piano. You know, the things that strike the metal chords? Then he attached them to some old rotisserie motors. So instead of imagining a rotating chicken, imagine rotating piano hammers that touch down on the organ keys. Before it closed in 1957, Paul's hometown of Wyandotte was home to Wyandotte Toys, one of the country's largest toy manufacturers. He used to love playing with the Erector sets and Tinker Toys made from the factory down the road. His dad even worked there for a little while when he was younger. Then, about 15 years ago, he started collecting the toys he loved as a kid. And then he started using them to make instruments and sound sculptures like this one.
The working class background of being in a suburb of Detroit all of your life makes you view things a little bit differently.
And that do-it-yourself aesthetic that's so familiar to people who grew up with parents working with their hands all day has really shaped the way Paul makes music.
Downriver, you're not expected to make a living doing something you enjoy doing. You're expected to go work in a factory.
And that's where Paul sees himself as different from a lot of the people and institutions he grew up around. He's not really interested in efficiency like the automakers are.
I just want to return to the fun of a machine that doesn't have a purpose. Or its only purpose is to play a toy piano in its clumsy little way. My father made a huge leap like several years ago when he actually said, Frank, I just figured out that you're the only person in the family that's doing what they want to do. And to me, that was almost a confirmation on his part. It was like, he wouldn't go so far as to say it's a good thing, but I kind of felt like, well, I'm glad you figured it out. I figured it out a long time ago that I didn't want to work in a factory, even though I've done it. And I've got nothing against people working in a factory, but given the option, yeah, you know, I'd far sooner do this.
Almost everyone in Michigan is, in some way, affected by the auto industry. And that's no different for Paul. So as the economy suffers, so does arts funding.
I used to just, like, wait to get that call so I could get, like, 5 commissions a year. So I figured if I got 5 commissions, then I could make a pretty lousy living, but I could, you know, keep away from the day job.
Paul has been experimenting with sound professionally for 15 years. And even though he's lost some commissions, he's still able to make ends meet. Between CD sales, gallery installations, the remaining arts commissions, and sporadic teaching gigs, he's able to pay most of his bills.
I feel very lucky to be able to live the life that I do. The day that I'll change my mind about that will probably be the day that I need health insurance for something, because I'm a healthy person, and so far that hasn't hit me. It's kind of amazing that I always make ends meet and there's always a job that's just around the corner. But again, when you're pushing 50, all those ads I see on TV about selling this drug and that drug, and by the way, if you're over such and such, you better have a something check. Anyhow, I would feel considerably better if I had health insurance.
Paul likes to joke that as he gets older, his toy collection actually gets bigger.
Kind of ironic, isn't it?
For Sidetrack, I'm Zach Rosen.
This is Sidetrack. Recently, the Champaign area music scene lost one of its biggest names. Much of the time, Jay Bennett was well known as being a part of the scene nationally as a member of the band Wilco. But before and after, he was a prominent part of it locally, writing and performing songs with groups like Titanic Love Affair and Steve Pride and his Bloodkin. On Memorial Day weekend, a reunion of artists and friends who had met in the late 80s quickly turned sour, as Bennett died suddenly and unexpectedly at the age of 45. Steve Pride bandmate Don Gerard was one of the organizers of that reunion. Jeff Bossert spoke with Gerard, who says that there's a much larger story on his friend's life and career that needs to be told.
Talk about the first time you met Jay Bennett. How'd you first get to know him, and how did your musical juices flow? How did you start talking about collaborating together?
Well, initially when I met him, I was not terribly impressed with him in any regards. He was playing in a band that played some covers, and I was playing in a more established band. And quite frankly, it was a number of years before I actually became friends with him. And we were actually a bit combative at times. It wasn't until years later when he found himself in a position where he needed a place to stay, and I was living in a house alone. He showed up on my doorstep, asked if he could crash for a week, and he wound up staying for a year and a half. And coincidentally, at the time, he had started contributing some guitar work to the group that we had, Steve Pride and his Bloodkin. And he was to come and play on some demos, and he just wound up staying, and we wound up having about a year and a half of just really intensive musical collaboration. And by that, I mean Jay taught me how to play music, basically. So
did your band exist prior to?
Yeah, it was a three-piece. Steve Shields, who under the name Steve Pride, had just really wanted to try to flesh out some demos and maybe take a shot at getting some sort of a songwriting contract or something. He just wanted a venue by which to sort of practice his craft, and there wasn't really any attention to have a regular recording or touring or performing band. He just really wanted sort of people to kind of hash out ideas with. And it just became a lot more. Once Jay joined, we started playing more. We started, we were a little bit ahead of our time. But, it just kind of became this thing where we were just playing music all the time. We were practicing 3 or 4 hours a night, 3 or 4 times a week, playing quite a bit, doing a lot of just going out and playing open mics, without a drummer, play open mic nights, play a couple songs, get a free beer. But just playing music, talking about music, going to see other shows, playing our own shows. It was just a really, 18 months to 2 years or so of just really intensive, making music.
And when was this?
This is like in the early 90s. I think it was, I'm trying to place the exact time, maybe like 92 to 94, somewhere in that era. It was just prior to him joining Wilco, as I noted. This was the band from which Jeff Tweedy's words, his quote was that he liked the band so much he stole their guitar player. Big money, big money. Turn on that.
I know Jay was a student here, but was this when he was doing the VCR repair, or what else was he doing with his time?
Well, that story is a bit of contention as well. When I lived with Jay, he had already been on a major label with Titanic Love Affair and released a couple of additional records on independent labels. So he was doing sessions where he would fly out to L.A. During this time, he also was doing some playing guitar with an artist by the name of Tommy Keane. So I was talking with Bob Andrews, who was one of Jay's and a manager, and he also managed Uncle Tupelo and the Bottle Rockets. And he said he was on tour with the Bottle Rockets when they saw Jay playing on Conan O'Brien with Tommy Keane, and said, "That's the guy. That's the guy from that band," because they had been, you know, very familiar with his work and kind of following him. So during that time, he was working fixing VCRs, because then he would have access to lots of equipment to fix his own gear, and he was also honing his craft as far as a technician. It wasn't as if he was just fixing VCRs and Jeff Tweedy showed up with a golden ticket and plucked him out. It was actually quite kind of the other way around. It seemed like Jeff Tweedy was really looking for somebody to collaborate, you know, with whom to collaborate, and Jay was that guy. What I wonder is my heart full of holes. Yeah, the feeling goes, but my hair keeps growing. Well, I set the sun on a big wheeled wagon. Let's talk about the number of different instruments he played. Was it strictly, in your band as more of a guitarist? Because Wilco, he was known so well for playing so many different instruments in post-production. Do we know that kind of musician yet? Absolutely. The very first session we played, actually, we had Brian Leach, who was in a band The Last Gentleman, now plays with the Great Crusades, playing mandolin. And it wasn't quite sounding right, and Jay grabbed the mandolin and said, "Some guy taught me this trick. If you want a mandolin to sound right, you have to knock it out of tune. That's how you get that kind of Godfather, you know, soundtrack tone out of a mandolin." And even at that time, just multi-instrumentalist, anything he would pick up, he would play piano, just virtually any instrument. You know, he was really just multi-talented. So, yes, we were well aware that he could play pretty much anything he picked up, even if he had never had before. You know, within a very short period of time, he will have, you know, figured out how to coax what sound he was looking for out of that instrument.
We touched very briefly on Jay joining Wilco, and I wonder if we could talk about the other end of that. Articles on Jay's death now focus largely on the demise of his relationship with Jeff Tweedy and the exchange between the two of them in the documentary, I Am Trying to Break Your Heart. Maybe we could talk more about what Jay did for that band during his 7 years there.
During that time, I talked to Jay on occasion, but we weren't nearly as close as we obviously had been. He would call me every now and then and say, "Hey, I'm with, you know, we're playing with REM in Amsterdam right now," or something, you know, and you know, just call me up to talk. But I wasn't intimately aware of what the goings on were at that time. I think once he joined the band, I think it really was a different band. And if you talk about the body of work, the Jay Bennett Wilco versus the non-Jay Bennett Wilco, they really, by my assessment, you know, my opinion, they could have changed the band's name because it really was two completely different bands. It really was as if, you know, you took the Beatles and Paul McCartney left or John Lennon had left. His collaborations with Jeff were much more. He was much more than a sideman. He wore many, many hats in that band. He was very, very, very much. That was very much at one point as much his band as Jeff's, in my opinion. And I think at some point Jeff wanted to take it back. And I think Jay himself has been cited on many occasions saying that, you know, he had every right to do so. And that was the proper move. As far as the movie goes, I have talked to a number of musicians who have played with him in bands over the year, and we all concur. There is the famous "The Scene," which leads up to his being dismissed from the band. And I'm trying to think of a way to put this like without sounding crass, but all of us said we had the same reaction. We all, when we saw that, laughed and said, "Well, yeah, that's Jay."
I misunderstood what I was saying. I assumed apparently wrong, that it was noise until heavy metal drummer started. But now I understand that it's orchestra until a subset of heavy metal drummer starts, then two measures later, heavy metal drummer really starts, right?
Sure.
Okay, I didn't know that. I thought we were just saying, hey, that would be cool if the noise went right up to heavy metal drummer. Does that make sense?
Whatever. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the problem is. I don't.
I just want you to understand me, like understand why I was thinking.
Why is it so important? I don't have to understand you all the time.
If you lived with Jay or played in a band with Jay, that's how Jay was. Either you could put up with it or you couldn't. And since he was embroiled in Wilco and they were a worldwide phenomenon, it was a very big deal in a feature film. It seemed a lot bigger, but we'd all seen that played out at some point. He was Jay, you know, and that's how he was, and that's why if he had not had that broad dynamic in his personality, he would not have had that broad dynamic as an artist.
Was he self-taught in a lot of instruments, or was it just, did he have tons of lessons growing up? Or?
I have some recollection that he may have told me at some point maybe he broke his leg or sprained his arm, did something during a Little League season, and that was his sort of formative year. He couldn't play Little League baseball, so instead he sat in his room slowing down the records to play the leads on guitar and learn the leads off of records and so forth. But I kind of have a thought about Jay in as much as, if you don't mind, if I just go ahead and... With Jay's passing, I started increasingly thinking about the book The Natural by Bernard Malamud, which is quite different from the movie. It's not the fairy tale. It's a little bit more of an immense Herculean talent who is also very human and flawed. And it's a bit of a tragic story, and not that Jay's life was a tragic story, but it made me think of Jay in the sense of that. If you think about Jay Bennett, what he accomplished in music is far greater than most people do. He put out a number of records with a number of projects. He was signed to a major label a couple of times. That body of work is out there. We can see that. What he accomplished as a student is greater than most of us will ever do. He had multiple 4 advanced degrees from the University of Illinois, and this is within the context of also doing all these musical things. What he accomplished as far as being able to fix a VCR or a toaster or anything is far greater than most of us will see. He was as good of a guitar tech as any guitar technician there is. He could set up any guitar, replace your wiring, put in new pickups, and it was just phenomenal. What he accomplished as far as repairing motor vehicles is far greater than most of us will do. He fixed his own cars. He would work on his own cars constantly. And over the course of his life, he continued to. He had an old Ford Falcon. I had a 74 Ford Ranchero that he got running from dust. So in all these things in his life, he did so many things. It seemed like he lived 5 or 6 lifetimes in 45 years. I mean, it was really, when I think about the things that I do and the things that he accomplished just in any one of these, categories is just amazing. He was just a phenomenal, bigger than life human being in many, many regards, far beyond music. And he was that way with his friends as well. He probably had more friends than any of us will have in our life. He's just a really sort of a heroic yet tragic figure. He was just an amazing, amazing person.
Jeff Bosser talked with Don Gerard, a longtime friend and musical collaborator of Jay Bennett, who passed away last month at the age of 45. Gerard says a memorial concert is planned for later this summer. In 2006, Jeff Bossert interviewed Bennett and asked him what led him to choose music as a career.
I think I spent a lot of time not really knowing if music was going to be a profession or a hobby for me. And some of that had to do with outside influence, like the woman I did my student teaching with saying, God, you're such a great teacher. I really hope that you can do the music as a hobby. And then, some other people in my life telling me the same thing. And then a lot of it was internal as well, just knowing that music's a pretty, an iffy thing to call your profession, because it can kind of fall apart at any moment, really. As it nearly has for me a couple of times, But I think it was when I met Ken Hartz from Titanic Love Affair. He was kind of the first person I met who I could consider. He was really my first kind of, first really satisfactory and satisfying and rewarding co-writer. And we really clicked writing songs together. And once I felt what that felt like, to write together and both be really satisfied with the product, and then, of course, being able to record it as well. And then the band going on to be, you know, being at least for a time relatively successful, you know, Titanic Love Affair. I owe a lot to Ken because we really clicked, and it was the first time I really felt like I was writing songs that were really up to par. You know, and a lot of that had to do with him. Just we just really clicked. We wrote together really well, and that was the kind of thing that kind of pushed me over into thinking, well, if I can keep working with this guy, you know, I'm going to make the commitment.
Here's a sample of Jay Bennett performing with Titanic Love Affair. He's featured here doing vocals on the song, The Wait.
She wants to know if you wrote a letter. She wants to know if you slept last night. She don't know if you wrote a letter. She don't know if you slept last night. Got a notion that I'll see you sometime. You've got a notion that I'm wrong. She wants to know if you're feeling better. She wants to know if you're drunk or stoned. Don't know if you're feeling bitter, and you don't know if you're drunk or stoned. I've got a notion that I'll see you sometime. You've got a notion that I'm.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. All the past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.